Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on your YouTube channel. I'm Helen Lowe, Senior Vice President of Marketing at Charles Schwab, and a member of the Board of Directors of the Charles Schwab Foundation. We are honored to be sponsoring today's program. Charles Schwab Foundation has been committed in promoting financial literacy for young people all over America, and we firmly believe in the power of financial education and community service to unleash people's potential. We have collaborated with the premier youth development organization, Boys and Girls Club of America, in co-creating an evidence-based teen financial education program called Money Matters, Make It Count. And through fun, interactive, and experiential activities, club teens learn the basics of money management, including the very important topic of planning for college and college education as an investment. Over 500,000 teens in 1,700 Boys and Girls Clubs across the country have completed the program, and close to $500,000 in college scholarships have been awarded. In addition, we're extending our financial literacy program to reach college-age students and those who are transitioning to the workplace through our Schwab MoneyWise on-campus pilot program in select universities, because we believe that this urgent conversation about the future of a college education in America is so critical. Please welcome our moderator, Dr. Monica Martinez, Commissioner of the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for Hispanics and a Senior Fellow for the Hewlett Foundation.
Thank you, Helen, for your introduction. And most of all, thank you to the Charles Schwab Foundation for support for hosting this summit about higher education today. Most of you have heard the clarion cry for globalization. We all know that for the United States to remain competitive in the global economy, our citizens must be innovative, versatile, and well-educated. Yet, the United States has slipped behind many other countries in college completion. U.S. college graduation rates rank 19th out of 28 countries. President Obama has set a goal for the U.S., and that is, by 2020, America will once again have the highest proportion of college graduates in the world. With that in mind, how can higher education at large, but particularly four-year institutions, make college more accessible, affordable, and be successful in preparing our college students so they can help our country remain globally competitive, and we can, in fact, meet the 2020 goal set forth by our president? To discuss these issues, we have a terrific panel of education leaders who are passionate about their work as advocates for education and represent the voices of multiple types of higher education institutions, both public and private, research institutions, as well as liberal arts college, from large universities to small colleges. They are, starting on the very far right, Alicia DeCoudreau, president of Mills College, Richard Ekman, president of the Council of Independent Colleges. He came from Washington, D.C. today. Mary Marcy, she crossed the Golden Gate Bridge today from the Dominican University of California. Claude Still, executive vice chancellor and provost, University of California, Berkeley, and former dean of Stanford University Graduate School of Education. And Mohamed Kiyomi, president of the California State University of San Jose. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm going to start. Thank you. I thought I would start off with just a big question. Some might even consider it kind of a softball question, but just kind of get our juices flowing. Before we kind of dig deeper into some of the national issues that we've been hearing about with higher education. So the first question is really, and I'm going to start with Claude from the University of California, Berkeley, is I'd love for each of you to share with us your perspectives on the role of higher education in our society, both here in the U.S., perhaps even California, or globally, but particularly talk about the good of higher education as really a public good and what else it does for our society.
Well, I think it's one of the United States' greatest inventions and achievements are these institutions of higher education that are represented on this panel. This evening, we're the envy of the world. We're one of our best exports is higher education. People come to get this. It contributes in many ways. I think it's you know from Jefferson, we know you need an educated population to have a real meaningful democracy. So they're absolutely essential to that. They're essential to the quality of life. The quality of life we enjoy in an area like this is so benefited by the institutions of higher education and their impact on individuals and the like. And they're just deeply important to our economies and to the forward movement of economic development in the nation and certainly in this region. I was looking at a statistic. I don't know the time frame for this, but when you're a provost at a university like Berkeley, you learn all the good statistics. So our alums have created something like 1.2 million jobs in the businesses that they've developed, and that has contributed something like $238 billion to the economy of the state and in the region over a long period of time. So the vigorous higher education institutions are essential to our personal development and I think to the quality of society we have.
And right, as well as economic development is what I hear. Given you represent a consortium of independent colleges, I wonder if you can speak from that perspective because of all the independent colleges you represent.
Well, I would agree with everything that Claude said, and I would be tempted to go a little further to talk about the particular contributions of the smaller private institutions. There's pretty good evidence that these institutions produce individuals who become extremely active in their communities, vote more frequently than others, give more to charity. In other words, this form of education does seem to correlate with greater civic engagement. And there's also some evidence that although the absolute numbers are small, the percentage of individuals who start out to study science and technology in these small colleges have a much greater likelihood of finishing both bachelor's degrees and PhDs than people who start out through other kinds of institutions. So there's kind of an efficiency argument for the good of society in fields of critical need.
Okay.
If I would just like to add to that Rich was talking about this in the context of students, and I think that's a huge contribution that higher education makes, not only to local communities, not only to the state, but to the country, and even more broadly than that.
I appreciate that. Our other liberal arts college wants to get in here.
I do. I think that when you started out, Monica, you were talking about the broad contributions and the really ambitious goals that President Obama has put out for higher education in the United States. One of the great strengths historically of American higher education has not just been the numbers of students that graduate with a bachelor's degree or the number of patents we may have from our research institutions, but the sheer diversity of American higher education, that we have a very diverse population. We also have a wide range of institutions that have particular niches that they fill within society. And what we do know about higher education, regardless of whether it's a community college, a small private, a large public, is that it is still the single greatest avenue to personal and social transformation in the world. So that's a return on investment that's hard to measure.
Great. No, thank you. Appreciate that. And last but not least, okay. Mo from CSU.
Well, I agree with what my colleagues have already said, but I wanted to bring a few additional items also. That for having democracy to flourish, we need an educated and engaged citizenry. And for that educated and engaged citizenry, we need universities. And it's cradles of democracy, they are the laboratories of democracy today, and they have always been so. So that's one aspect of it. I think the other aspect of it, specifically looking at an institution like San Jose State, and we're looking in an urban environment, we have three major stewardship. One, how we can build the human capital of our region. Second, how we can build and enhance the economic vibrancy of the region. And third, how we can build healthy and thriving communities. And also another dimension would be is the creation of new knowledge and the research that is needed about all of the different issues of our society, and that dialogue in an environment that it's not, that one can really disagree. And actually, disagreement is one of the things in higher education we really thrive on, but keeping within the environment of civility. So I think all of these are unique elements and multidimensional aspect of the values that higher education really brings.
That's wonderful. I appreciate the very different, unique perspectives and at the same time the similar perspectives. And I really wanted to start with that question because sometimes we forget about the larger context and value of higher ed. And the reason why I start with a big question is now we're going to talk about the question that's in the headlines constantly, and that's about the cost of higher education, right? Or more specifically, about tuition and about affordability. And you know, there isn't a single person I don't talk to who's either delaying retirement or you know, starting to work again to make sure that they can afford their child to go through higher education. So we're going to go a little deeper now and try to remember the intrinsic value and the extrinsic value of higher education. But, you know, there's been a lot of criticism about the cost of tuition increasing, you know, at a higher rate of inflation than everything else in the United States. And so what is really driving the increased cost of tuition, and what can we do about that? I'll start with Claude.
I'd pass that. No.
I mean, let's remember there were students camped out in the chancellor's office, I think, just last year, and often it actually happens there often a lot, but specifically about cost.
Well, it's an incredibly important issue. I'll say a little bit about publics. I'll say a little bit what I think is driving these costs, and then I'll say a little bit about whether it's worth you get a return on your investment for that. So those are things I'd like to mention. There has been, with regard to large public or the public higher education in general, a pulling back of state support over the last 30 years in a gradual way. So if you go back 30 years ago, the state contributed directly enough money to keep tuition either at zero or at a very small rate. So many people in an earlier generation went to Cal, to UC Berkeley, paid no tuition whatsoever. And that was in an era when the state really funded Berkeley. It enabled that to be the case. But over the years, as state budgets, state economies have been stressed, this is a national phenomenon, but it's certainly true in California, there's just been less and less direct support of that university. So at this point, only 13% of our budget, of the money it takes to run that place, comes directly from the state, 13%. And that is not uncommon throughout the country. Sometimes people don't realize that. And as that state contribution has been withdrawn, the burden has been shifted gradually to tuition, to raising tuition from student. The other big sector of income for a university like mine is research. So probably almost 40% of our budget comes from the research that faculty do. I want to stick that in because I think people forget that in this equation. But why, though, even in the private sector, have costs in universities gone up over a period of time? Is it because, A, universities don't do a good job of managing their costs, faculty don't teach enough, we've gilded campuses, there are, you know, we have climbing rocks, and we, you know, there's a whole discourse that lays the blame at the foot of the university, things going on inside the university that increase the costs. But there are another story to tell, which is that basically it is a labor-intensive industry, higher education. You have to do it with professors teaching students in big part, and staff supporting that effort in big part. And you don't benefit. And in addition to that, it is a highly educated labor force. Over the last 30 years, our higher education has not produced educated workers at the level that the economy demands them. So we're undersupplied in terms of highly educated people, if I can put it that way. That increases their incomes, and that becomes part of the expense that a university has to bear in order to function. Over time, you don't benefit like maybe an industrial industry might benefit from technology, which would make it cheaper and cheaper to make iPhones, for example. It doesn't get cheaper and cheaper to hire professors who teach courses, who do research and the like. All of those things that I just described, they go up just a little bit higher than inflation, because inflation comes down a little bit because you can enjoy the benefits of technology. As technology has made major advances, it's actually costs us more because we have to keep up with the technology. We have to get the latest technology to do the best science, to continue to run these institutions as cutting-edge, leading institutions. Well, these things cost. And so the cost that you have to charge in order to run an institution like that go up. It's very important to point out that our costs increase at the same rate that all comparable service industries increase. There's nothing particularly peculiar about higher education. Medicine follows the same increase in costs. Legal services, dentistry, anything where you're using that kind of.
So Claude has clearly stated the problem pretty comprehensively for all of us. So how about we move
excuse
more?
My
that's quite okay.
But
no, that's good. But no, you gave us a.
I wanted to get the argument out.
So no, but I would love for the rest to then tell us how we're addressing all these issues. So what I hear from Claude is that hey, this is just the reality. It's heavy human capital. This is the situation. Yet certainly the public is not particularly happy with that situation. So I'd love to hear, we'll start with you, Rich, from the independent college sector, and then Mary, I know you just raised $25 million, which was the largest gift, I believe, that Dominican has received. So tell me how we're solving this problem. And
sure.
And Alicia has some experience from the corporate sector, so as does Mo, so if you have any perspective from that. But I'd love for the four of you to just kind of give me one idea on how we can subsidize the cost, to Claude's point about not having the students take on the burden so much, or how we can defray some of the costs. So, Rich, how about we start with you?
Well, I think the first thing is we need to make a distinction between cost and price. You know, most institutions don't charge tuition that covers the total cost of educating a student. And for a wealthy private research university, the tuition is a tiny fraction of the cost per student of running that institution. For most institutions with small endowments, however, the price reflects a fairly sizable fraction of the total cost of educating the student. And for our friends in the public university world, they are victims of the caprice of state legislatures and others, where for whatever reasons that have to do with the state budget, the tuition price can go up and down quite unreasonably in relation to the actual costs. In the private college and university world, the way in which colleges have responded is by raising a lot of money for scholarships. And understand what that means, that given the choice of things that a president or a board of trustees might emphasize, you know, new buildings, endowed chairs, whatever, many, many of them have put the top priority on raising scholarship money, so much so that the amount of institutional raised money that's distributed to students at private colleges is equal to 6 times the amount of Pell Grant money that's distributed to those same students. So it's enormous commitment to make college possible for students from low-income backgrounds. There's a lot of myth-making around this. One of the myths has to do with this trillion-dollar figure of student debt. Journalists like to say there's $1 trillion of student debt out there. Debt is out of control. The cost of college is out of control. The colleges are to blame. Well, you know, we've been expanding college going in this country, and the people going to college these days are disproportionately drawn from low-income and first-generation backgrounds. So, of course, it's going to take more money in scholarship funds to make it possible for them to go to college. And if you look at that $1 trillion of debt and you break it down, it turns out that 1/3 of all graduates of private colleges have no debt whatsoever, and another 1/3 have debt that is below $20,000. So you have to ask the question, is $20,000 a big number or a small number? Is it a reasonable investment in your lifetime earnings capacity when everyone seems to agree that your lifetime earnings differential, if you're a college graduate, is somewhere between $700,000 and $1.3 million? So you got to put this argument of the rising cost of college in proportion to other things.
Great, thank you. Well, one of the things that you just talked about, and certainly most all of you as presidents have felt this, is you are chief fundraisers. So, Mary, talk about you're relatively new still to Dominican. You just, I think, had your biggest gift ever of $25 million. So, tell us a little bit about how you have to raise money to underwrite many of these costs and not pass that on into tuition.
Sure, I think that one of the first things people ask me, and I'll bet it's true of my colleagues, is I'll bet you spend a lot of time raising money. Do you like that? Actually, I do, but I'll tell you why. Raising money for an enterprise like Dominican, I think, or any other institution of higher education, is not not about asking people for money. It's actually building something that shapes the future of our world, quite simply. How do we do this, and how do we do it more effectively? And for an institution like ours, which is highly diverse. I often say that we look like California, and therefore we look like the future of the United States. Half our students, I know this is similar at Mills, students of color, you know, another third are on Pell Grants. How do you create an educational model that responds effectively to that kind of student so they can be successful? If we truly believe this is the avenue to the American dream, how do we open up that avenue so it can be effective for more students? So what we focus on is not only we need more funds to do what we do, we actually focus on how can we do what we do more effectively, make sure that we have a very high quality, high impact experience for every student that comes onto campus. So very simple. Every student when they come in is going to have a peer mentor from the time they walk in the door. Every student is going to have some kind of active, engaged learning experience before they leave. Every student is going to have a capstone project before they leave. And once they graduate, they're going to graduate ready for graduate school or employment. I don't care if they're majoring in history or business or health sciences. So we start by talking about that vision, and then we say, how do we make it happen? Because we know this is what's most effective for the types of students coming to American higher education today. Does some of it cost money? Absolutely. But some of it actually invites innovation that doesn't necessarily cost money. It invites change and creativity. And some of those resources that you raise can then help to offset the bottom line cost of college.
Right. Unless anyone wants to comment more, I want to shift that a little bit to financial aid, which is, I think, Mo, though, would like to make a comment.
Yeah, let me add a couple of comments also. First of all, I think the cost increase has been tremendous. And for California specifically, I think it has created a second problem. You know, we all talk about the drought and how serious our drought has been and the kind of economic impact and hardship that it's going to create. But in a way, that California has a second drought, and that drought is not having adequate technologically fluent students, graduates that our industries need. And as part of that one, we potentially could really negatively impact the future of California. And that's basically part of it is how much students have access to higher education. And also those who come to higher education, so many of them are not ready. I mean, so many students end up taking remedial classes. If you look at it nationally, over 50% of the students who come as first-time freshmen end up taking remedial math or remedial English or both. For many of them, that means about a semester or more of work that they end up doing. So I think if we can do most of that one before the students get to college and they're college-ready, that can save us quite a bit. The second part is how, when, for many cases, students end up taking their education in maybe one or two community colleges and then to an institution, and then also they may end up changing their major. So for a 120-credit degree, they end up taking about 150 to 180 credits. Specifically in California, for students who go to community college and then go to a four-year institution, on the average, they take about 154 credits for a 120-credit degree. So they end up spending an additional year. So that's another element. That one of the, you know, the few things that we have done at San Jose State, one, we're trying to see how we can help specifically underrepresented students on the area of retention and graduation to really work with them from the beginning with a number of high-impact programs in the area of undergraduate research, internships, service learning, and other ways to really connect them to the university.
Let's switch over to financial aid, and Alicia will have you address this question first. But how are you addressing financial supports in students, including helping the students and their parents be financially literate and understand the realities of paying for the college now and after graduation? And often they might accumulate debt not just with student loans, but with credit cards and other things they're doing while they're in school. So how do you help them package the financial aid to be able to afford the college, as well as maybe even think about the debt they may or may not be incurring and how they manage that as well?
Well, thank you for that question. I think, first of all, it starts with educating students before they even apply to us. And that starts with counselors in K through 12. And so I think to the extent that we can help the counselors to understand what we do and how we do it, and help the counselors to understand that while our sticker price, as Rich put it, may look high, that for many students we are incredibly affordable because of the institutional aid that we provide. And so we work very closely with students and their families as they are completing the application process to make sure that they truly understand what it will cost them not just what the sticker price is. And at Mills, 95% of our students receive financial aid. And I think there's a number that Rich probably knows better than I do, but around 80% of the students who go to private colleges are receiving institutional aid. And so as Mary was talking about fundraising, we do spend a lot of time raising funds to provide scholarships for students. And as I said, at Mills, 95% of our students are receiving some of that aid. So we try to make sure that parents and students understand not only what the cost is, but then what they will have to pay, when they will have to pay it. We really work with them on payment plans, and we do everything we can to ensure that when they leave, they leave with their degree in 4 years. And for us at Mills, we have an accelerated bachelor to master's program, and so in 5 years they can leave with the 2 degrees, and that they know when they leave exactly what they've paid for it and what they will have to pay going forward. And we try to make sure that the cost really is affordable for our students, because the last thing we would want to do is to have students come and then not be able to afford it, or to have them leave and leave with such debt that they are never able to fully utilize their education.
Great. I appreciate that question. That's really, anybody else want to add to that?
I would just stick in that we publics try to do the same thing. Our tuitions are, as at least to some degree, subsidized by the state, so our tuition level is somewhat lower than it is at private universities. But even there, at UC Berkeley, we have a graduated program so that anybody with an income lower than $80,000 from the family pays no tuition. Those tuition dollars are paid to the university, but they're paid by various scholarship programs, federal, state, and private scholarship funds. And then up to about $150,000, the tuition is modulated based on your income. It's a progressive tuition, so you're paying less than the sticker price. So we try to be, in those various ways, as a state university, have a fundamentally low tuition to begin with, and then we're very responsive to families' resources and their ability to pay tuition with these kinds of programs.
Okay. I think Mo wanted to get in here, and then I want to transition the question a little bit at cost, but a different perspective.
Yeah, I think to what Claude said, I can say the same for California State University system. Families of income of $80,000 or lower, they don't pay any tuition for all of the aids that we have, and also families that have $200,000 or less, with all of the tax deduction that they get on the federal level and the tuition that they pay, they almost cancel each other out. So basically, they are paying the cost of all of the living expenses and books and everything else.
Yeah.
So I'm going to change up the question still on financial aid to be a little bit more perhaps controversial. This came from the audience, and it was a question we had talked about previously too. But as wonderfully framed by someone in the audience, they said, if higher education is a public good with a transformative effect on the student in terms of economic advancement, and then, of course, we talked about the transformative effect on our society at large around democracy and economic development, shouldn't it be free? And whoever the audience member was took very good notes. Let me add to that. So there's two nuances that I want to add, right? So the first one is President Obama has announced that he would like to see the first 2 years of college free, particularly through community college. But second of all, we are one of the richest countries in the world, and most importantly, we know from statistics that a high school degree is not sufficient for our children in the future to have a livable wage. So let's take this person's question. Shouldn't it be free?
I would characterize certainly us in the public as clawing day and night to make that get closer
to
that ideal. I mean, I think it's a wonderful ideal, but I think we used to, as a society, fulfill that ideal. But in decades, let me just pick 3 decades or so, we've come to think of education as much as being a private good as it is a public good, and the responsibility for paying the state legislatures, the population in California, the various propositions have withered away at the capacity for states to contribute to higher education at a level that would enable tuition to be free.
So
there's been a kind of a cultural shift that has made that decision that people should pay for that, and I think we all are part of that in some way. And I think in discussing this, that's kind of where the discussion should begin. We really have as a society, come to a different decision about that. And that's where we are at this point. So,
I wonder, as a society, if we've made that decision, given our president just announced that we should offer 2 years of free college through our community colleges. I'm going to start with Alicia, because I feel like she's at the end, and I never get to her till the end.
Rich has been leaning in some because he's dying to say something, so I'll follow him.
Okay, so, but I do want to address again, and I imagine there's some, you know, there's very few funds available to us, and if a state makes room for free college at a community college, it means less money for our four-year institutions. So that could be maybe one of the pushbacks. But we've had now other states like Tennessee start to provide 2 years of free college at a community college. So, Rich, jump on in and tell me what you think that kind of policy implication would have with regard to opening up our higher education system.
Yeah. First, can I change the vocabulary? Instead of talking about public benefit and private benefit, can we talk about individual benefit and societal benefit? Because I would argue that the private institutions, like the public institutions, are also concerned with societal good.
Absolutely.
And the public institutions also equip individuals to be successful in their own lives, as well as the private institutions. So if we can kind of neutralize the vocabulary a little bit.
Absolutely,
yes.
The argument I would make is that when California and when the City University of New York first came on the scene with the idea of very low cost or free tuition, this was a bold innovation because private higher education dominated at that time, and it did charge tuition. And what's happened over time is that as the states have been under pressure, the states have put more burden on the institutions to pass along costs to students or to others. And the growing government role in providing higher education has often, I'm not saying this is the case in California, but has often been carried out in a way that has been oblivious to the opportunities that already exist in the private sector. So you will have public institutions being created in parts of a state that are pretty well served by private institutions. So the question is, when a state budget is squeezed, what should it do with a dollar it has to spend on providing higher education opportunities for the citizens of the state? Should it always go into the public institution, or should it be used to help a student going to a private institution? I don't think any states have thought that through terribly well as a matter of public policy.
Great point.
Well, and I would add to that that there are so many myths out there about the cost of education. And so I think to the question you raised earlier, we do have to make sure that people really understand what they're paying for it. And I think that there are also myths out there about accessibility of some of the private institutions, particularly institutions like Mills College, where people think that this is an institution for wealthy, white, you know, students coming out of well-educated families. And yet 54% of our students are students of color. 33% of our students are first-generation students. 16% of our students are non-traditionally aged students. And so we are serving a population of students and doing so at great cost to the institution, given the kind of institutional aid that we provide to them, that provides access to students who would not probably otherwise have an opportunity for the kind of education that we provide. And so as long as the debate is solely around cost and should it be free, and not really, as Rich was saying, what this means for the individual, what it means for the society, and the various ways in which institutions, whether they're public, private, two-year, or whatever, the various ways in which we are equipping people to achieve their education by virtue of the grants that we're giving them and by virtue of the opportunities that we give them for internships, the ways in which they are able to gain experiential learning while they are within our institutions. I think we need to think about the full picture as we talk about the cost of education and answer the question as to whether or not it should be free. I'm still looking for something free in life, by the way.
Great. We all are. A reminder for our radio audience. This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking about the future and value of college with a brilliant panel of educators. They are Alicia Descoudreaux, president of Mills College, Richard Ekman, president, Council of Independent Colleges, Mary Marcy, president, Dominican University of California, Claude Still, executive vice chancellor and provost of the University of California, Berkeley, and Mohamed Kayume, president of California State University. I am Monica Martinez, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on your YouTube channel. Mo, I know you wanted to get into this question on financial aid or cost or 2 years of free college, whichever one you'd like to go for, and then we'll move on. We'll move on to our next combination.
There is a lot of statistics. If you look at in the last 40 years since the Higher Education Master Plan in California, you can almost correlate the private economic vitality of the state to the amount of investment that the state has made in higher education. There's almost a perfect correlation between the two. And right now, I'm sure the same as what you see in the for the California state system, for every dollar of state investment, the return to the state has been $4.7. That's a heck of an investment. So if you really take that investment for, you know, part of it is that as a society, as a community, and as a citizenry, where we really want to put make our investment, and recognizing that higher education is an investment, not a state cost. And I think if we look at it in that kind of a framework, whether we really look at our public institutions, whether we look at our private institutions, all of that really shows that it had the return that they have, the societal return has been tremendous. And that's why the more we can make it easily accessible for people, so anybody who is ready and would like to go to college have that opportunity. That basically is, the way that we can achieve where we want to go.
Well, thank you, Mo, and you actually have provided a great segue to our next question, and I want Alicia to lead off, and then, Mo, I would like for you to follow Alicia. And just a separate note, on most of the questions that are coming in are about cost, financial aid, tuition. So this is still on everybody's mind. But we're going to move into the discussion about equity. You ended with that. Many of the questions have come in also related to equity issues or actually access. So, you know, minority enrollment and attainment, there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is, you know, more and more African Americans and Latinos are graduating from high school, more and more are going on to college. And the bad news is there's still a low percentage of students of color who complete college. So, and as the demographic shifts, we're going to have a higher number of Latinos and African Americans. And, of course, our baby boomers are retiring, and we're not keeping up. The college attainment is not keeping up. Alicia, I'm going to start with you because you do have over 54% of your students at a private institution that traditionally served women, very historical college. How have you been addressing the access issue for students of color? How you've been so successful. Tell me what you're doing to ensure that you're having students come to your college.
Well, first of all, we've been working at this for a long time. And so over the years, as we have made a conscious effort to try to ensure that our population does mirror the population of California and that we do have a very diverse set of students within our institution. And again, much of this starts with K through 12 and with the kind of counseling in particular that's given in high schools, so that students who may not be sitting around the table, the dinner table, having conversations with their parents about SATs and how to be prepared for college, they have counselors who are helping them with that. So one of the things we do is we do reach out to high school counselors. But then once students come to a place like Mills, and I can speak very specifically to a program that we offer, it's very, very helpful if we can help students, not with remedial programming, because that's not what we do, but with programming that helps to acclimate them to college. So once they get to us, so that they can be successful. And we actually have at Mills a program called a Summer Academic Workshop. And it is a residential program that we offer to students for 2 weeks in the summer. When they come to campus, they actually participate in mock classrooms. They are really introduced to the study of subjects at the college level in this program, so that they really are ready to learn at the college level from day one. Many of the issues that they are not familiar with, they get familiar with during that period of time. And the students who participate in this program persist at a very, very high rate. They also are the students who have, who are amongst our highest achieving students. And so we know that we do need to reach out differently and reach out broadly to bring a greater diversity to our institution. But once we do that, it's not enough simply to enroll a diverse population. It's really important that we recognize the various needs of this population, particularly one, as I mentioned, where we have 33% of our students who are first generation. So we need to reach out to that population and ensure that as early as we can, we prepare them to succeed throughout their college years. And a program like the Summer Academic Workshop does just that.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate that. I appreciate your comment, too, that this has been a long and continued effort by your part. Mo, I'd love for you to comment specifically from your lens of CSU San Jose, but as a system, CSU, because we do have a system here in California of our community colleges, our state universities, and then our University of California as in Berkeley. Tell me how CSU at large and San Jose is really working to ensure that we are enrolling students of color, Latinos, African Americans, first generation students.
Well, we have many outreach programs that start with many of the middle school students, because seventh and eighth grade is one of those pivotal moments of whether a student will actually finish high school or even continue on and go to college. So one of the major predictors of that one is their success rate in Algebra 1. Those who fail Algebra 1, there is a high propensity they do not even finish high school. I think about 50% of them in California do not even finish high school. And even before that one, in the third grade, the reading ability really determine whether they're going to continue on. So these are some of the very fundamental issues that we try to work with many of the high schools. And the second element is that it's true that we are, for instance, for San Jose State, we have a very diverse population, which reflects the state. Actually, we have about 27% Latinos, 33% Caucasian, about 38% Asian Pacific Islander, and the rest be non-state and international. But the important element that we see is how we can really help all of those students at all of the levels, because many of them are first-generation college students, and elements such as internships to really know how the work environment is, the kind of counseling that the first generation really needs, having learning communities and having residence halls available for all of these students. Undergraduate research is one of the other elements that we found to be quite important, because all of these elements collectively really help our students. And then lastly, how we can really make sure that students develop as basic elements of technological fluency, whether they study liberal arts, social sciences, engineering, or hard sciences. For all of them, they require a certain level of technological fluency to be successful today.
Great. And so, Mo, I really appreciate you starting to hit on the success factors, too. So, you know, K-12 loves to point their fingers at higher ed, and higher ed loves to point their fingers at K-12, and so we get to hear that. And so now we have, you know, an increasing number of students in higher ed, and yes, we do have an increasing number of students who are unprepared for higher education, and remediation certainly doesn't end up helping them accelerate through their programs in higher education. So the rest of you, Mo kind of listed a couple of programs he has placed in his university to ensure students are graduating and we don't have this attainment gap between our students of high wealth, low wealth. And so I open it up to either you, Rich, Mary, yeah. Claude, to talk about other programs to ensure that our students are successful in graduating in a timely way, because this also has an impact on cost, which I think, Rich, you brought up previously as well. Mm-hmm. So the floor is open for any of the
three. Let me kind of set a context for this. Statistically, highly selective institutions like Berkeley aside, but statistically, for most colleges and universities in the country, the proportions of students who are enrolled from various racial and ethnic groups is about the same between public and private. But when you look at the degree completion rates, they're better for the medium selective private institutions, and that's clearly traceable to the smaller scale and the ability to mount some of the programs like those that Alicia described. The ones that Mo described are obviously equally effective, but the larger scale makes it harder to deliver those programs without more money. So we know what we need to do to help students from different racial and ethnic backgrounds, different levels of prior preparation to succeed in college, but we have to find a way to pay for it.
Great. Does anyone else want to add, and then we'll move on? And also,
As a school like Mo's that has to deal with these challenges in considerable scale, I do think higher education has made really some important steps forward, and I'd like to at least register that in being able to accomplish that at a school like Berkeley, about 38% of our students are Pell Grant students, which is a very large number. That's almost 10,000 students come from homes whose incomes are roughly lower than $48,000 a year, and we have, like many of the programs mentioned here, we have serious commitment to outreach and to the high schools in the state. We have bridge programs that help students acclimate to a big university environment like that, a complicated, challenging university environment like that. And we have many programs within the university to help students get the most out of that kind of an experience. It's potentially a daunting experience, but it can be incredibly enriching, and you're trying to help kids sort of get to the other side of intimidation and into the side where they feel like they belong and can function and can benefit from that. And I think we're getting better and better at it. There was an article in yesterday's New York Times describing a study at Berkeley that has been very successful at getting women into engineering. Because part of the challenge is to get groups from different backgrounds spread out all over the curriculum so that they get the full opportunity, exposure to opportunities that a school like that provides. And one of the secrets was to simply have the engineering course focused on doing engineering to alleviate poverty. That attracted a lot more women than had ever been attracted to enroll in courses like that. So I think really as a result of all the efforts that you're hearing about here, higher education is getting very sophisticated at helping people develop. This is the college years are basically another phase of human development, and you don't want to forget that that's what we're in big part engaged in, is helping people find themselves, find a path in life. In addition to the content and the particular skills and knowledge, you're helping them get a real focus in life, pull together. I think higher education in the United States does an incredibly good job under it, under increasing financial pressures, as you've heard a great deal about. But I don't want to miss mentioning what I think has been accomplished there, which is, as I say, we have here some of the best institutions in higher education in the world. We lead the world in this area.
Right. Well, just look at the institutions we have right here in San Francisco, and this isn't even all of them. There was a question from the audience, and so it's a variation of this question about equity. And this is actually a really great question that I didn't want us to leave this conversation with. We have a lot fewer males graduating from high school, particularly Latinos and African Americans, and we certainly have a lot fewer graduating from college as well. And Claude just raised the fact that we are starting to prioritize women in STEM fields and some of these underrepresented fields. Just a curious question from the audience is, do any of you have a program that's set up to ensure males are successful in completing college? Has this kind of shown up as an issue on your campus, and is there something that you've had to address? Mary, you're nodding your head. Is that something you've had to address at Dominican?
Well, I think we focused on underrepresented students as a whole. And so we have targeted, I wasn't talking before because these pieces sound fairly familiar in terms of trying to start with outreach in the schools and take it all the way through the undergraduate experience and graduate experience at our place. A big part of, I think, success for underrepresented students, and this includes men in certain fields and men being successful in college, is actually alignment of the faculty profile and the advising profile with the students that you see. So if we have a highly diverse student body, we want to have a highly diverse faculty, we want to have a highly diverse advising system, because it helps students to understand how they can be successful beyond. It's not simply telling them they can, but it's actually modeling that potential success. We don't have a specific program focusing on young men. We actually don't have a specific program focusing on young women either, but we have had tremendous success when we look at not only who comes in, but if we look at the long-term retention rates and graduation rates for subgroups, it's pretty consistent for most of our subgroups. There are a couple of areas where we feel like we could do better, and we've actually just started that conversation on campus, particularly with some young men from underrepresented groups. Do we need to do more conscious intervention in terms of advising or support systems?
Great. Thank you, Mary. I'm going to, and I appreciate the audience from the question from the audience member. I'm going to shift direction a little bit and talk a little bit more about the content and the quality of the learning experience that our students receive once they go to college, since we've heard such good things about our universities. So a few years ago, and I'm sure folks up here on the panel heard of the book called Academically Adrift. It was a four-year study by a professor out of NYU, my alma mater. Yes, and Rich is already smiling. That he concluded after a four-year study, American higher education is characterized by limited or no learning for a large portion of students. And the statistics were pretty staggering. Something like 48% of our students did not learn anything within the first 2 years of college. And it goes on into a third of our students by the time they graduated. So I'm going to have Mary lead off this question because this has really been a priority as a president of Dominican for her. But how are you developing our students to be learners? And I have personal stake in this. I wrote a book called Deeper Learning, which was designed for K-12 teachers about developing students who are critical thinkers, collaborators, communicators, problem solvers, analytic, and most of all have self-direction and an academic mindset. How are we developing this in our higher education? And Mary, I'm going to lead with you. And then Rich, because of the smile on your face, I'm going to go to you next. And then I'll go to Saul.
Well, I'm going to do the easy part, which is saying some of the things that I think we do at Dominican that have been particularly successful. And I'm going to let Rich get up to trouble by taking issue with it academically adrift. I think you have some pretty good data on the outcomes there. I think that one of the things that I was thinking about in preparation for this panel was actually the what it is we try to do within higher education and the nature of innovation. Because we've heard, a number of you have probably heard this, higher education's going the way of the newspaper business, right? Newspapers didn't see what was coming and all of a sudden, everything became available online and they're all in trouble. What's different is that I think for newspapers, they had a product that could be almost completely duplicated in a way that was cheaper, faster, and more in the moment. Meaningful higher education cannot simply be duplicated by content delivery. None of us experience effective education simply because we read a good book or a book with lots of information in it, or we found something on Google that was, deeply insightful, and all of a sudden we thought we should have a bachelor's degree because we could Google it. We don't think that's not education. Education is actually engaging deeply with the questions and the work with a guide, mentor, usually a faculty member, who can challenge you to think more deeply, who can allow you to make mistakes, who can help you learn from those mistakes, who invites you to work with other students to solve real-world problems. So if you're in a physics class, you're in a chemistry class, you don't stand listening to somebody talking the sage on the stage. You go to the laboratory, and you try it out, and you make mistakes, and you have new ideas about how to solve a problem. That's the intensity of quality education, and it's highly personal, which is also why it can be expensive. But I think I will tell you one specific thing. This recent at Dominican, we just had our first annual university-wide scholarly and creative works conference. It's because every student at Dominican as an undergraduate does a capstone experience before they graduate, but we didn't all get to see it. And so we suspended classes. We spent 2 days, and students were in a conference. They presented their work just as they would at any other scholarly conference, undergraduate students and graduate students alike. And what we saw was students attending tons of other people's presentations, not because they were their friends, but because they wanted to learn, because they were curious, because this is what being in college is like. And this is what makes an educated person. And at the end of the day, and I know that there are hundreds, indeed thousands of business people who will tell you this, they're not just looking for someone who has a specific credential in order to do a specific job. They're looking for someone who can think, who can problem solve, who can communicate, who can work in teams. And that's what meaningful higher education looks like. It has nothing to do with a professor who's smarter than everybody else standing on the stage, telling you the solution to the problem.
Thank you, Mary. I really appreciate that. Rich, before I go to you, we're kind of in the home stretch of our show. So I want to talk about this a little bit more. I also want Claude to share his experience teaching and what makes for good teaching, because he won an award when he was at Stanford as Professor of the Year. 1 year, I think, in the school of, you're psychology, not for in the school psychology. Of education. So I want to focus a little bit on the content and quality, but there's been a lot of questions from the audience about the online and innovation part. So Rich, if we can limit our criticisms about the book, Academically Adrift, and focus on what makes good teaching in our school, and leave time for Claude to that, so that we can also then move on to innovation, where I'd like to have Mo lead off a conversation
with the questions.
Well, I can do that quickly. I agree with everything that Mary said.
All right. I love it. All right. So, Claude, we want your secret magic for being Teacher of the Year at Stanford. That was a pretty amazing award. Tell us about what you think makes for good teaching in higher ed and how we can move higher ed institutions to be teaching institutions and not just professors to do amazing research and know their content well.
Well, good teaching, again, I would agree with what Mary said. I thought she described it really eloquently and got to the heart of what you're trying to do. It is personal. You're trying to ignite interest. You're trying to help people sort of see a new path a path that their life could take. And so when you're doing it, I mean, I think I tried as a professor to be clear, to be consistently interesting, to ignite curiosity, to engage, and to give students a sense that this is a challenging world, but they've got the potential to achieve in it. That combination of elements, I think, galvanizes people and enables them to commit to the kind of paths that we offer in higher education, that higher education offers to students. So, you know, I don't want to over-describe it, but because I think on a daily basis, it's very simple human contact of the sort that Mary described, and you're just paying attention to having that kind of a relationship with students. And I would say that I wouldn't say that everybody is a great teacher, but boy, most faculty try really hard to do it. It's not fun to be a not good teacher and to have people sleeping in front of you. And so I mean, people try valiantly to do it. The image of the disinterested faculty, I think, is way overplayed. That most of the faculty that I know, really try and find a way. There are multiple ways you can be a good teacher. Different personalities do it in different ways. I'm sure everybody in the audience has experienced that. Some people are pretty... are really charismatic, and other people are really clear and calm, and there are a lot of ways to do it effectively. But I do want to stress that I think for the most part, faculty are dedicated to that part of their lives, even if they are as good as even if they're able to get a Nobel Prize in their research. Yeah. They also care about that room full of 21-year-olds who are sitting in front of them. They want to bring them in to their world to show them what delights them and to ignite the same kind of interest that they feel. It's a part of the whole mission, profession.
Well, Mary, thank you for setting the vision and Claude for just kind of bringing it home and sharing your personal experience. So we are going to transition a little bit around innovation and online learning. There was a lot of questions from the audience about that. So I'll quote another book that Rich will take issue with. And it is called The End of College. And it is by Kevin Carey. And basically, Kevin Carey says we're entering the era of the college from everywhere. And with exploding tuition prices and the global economy, it's going to force the college to do things differently. And we will see the end of the physical experience of attending a college campus. Many of you may have heard of the Minerva Project that's here in San Francisco, where it's an online platform 100% where students will go through college even though they can live in dorms as if they're going to a traditional physically based university. So, and Mary started hitting on this, and so did Claude, about the role of the kind of the physical and the human nature of learning. So what do we lose by not having an on-campus physical experience by attending a university of sorts, a college? And Mo has been a leader in this field with his background, has just written a report for CSU San Jose around innovation, online learning. So I would like for Mo to lead us off in talking about the online experience versus the physical experience and the future of how do we rethink college.
I look at online experience as part and parcel of the physical experience also. I don't think we can say that we can have one or the other. It basically is one can complement the other and one can really reinforce the other. I think whether it's in the online environment or the physical environment, we have to remember that education is a social activity. It has to be contextual. Mm-hmm. It has to, and as part of the deep element of learning, as what Mary Claude talked about, we're really talking about an experience that people can. It's not only just learning the answers, because if you want the answers, we can all Google something. But the more important element is: can you are you able to ask the right questions? And asking the right question is really creating that context, which is more important. Like, think I quote, there was a quote from Picasso that said, well, computers are useless because they only give you answers. So college education is really learning a set of facts and content and figures, that's not really learning. So, and this is basically where the role of innovation and the value of college education becomes more important, because you really instill and titillate that the joy of learning, the joy of discovery. And with simply the way that I try to explain it is like that learning and innovation is like drinking salt water to quench your thirst. The more you drink it, the thirstier that you get. And to me, that really is kind of the embodiment of what innovation and learning is and what the college experience is really supposed to be for any student.
Thank you. Alicia, how would you rethink college for the future?
Well, I think it's very, very important that we understand that the human element is so critical in education. And I think there's a lot of room for technology in the education process, but there's no substitute for the kind of interaction that Claude was talking about. There's no substitute for that constant conversation that you're having with students where you're igniting, as he said, their excitement about something. And I think it's very important that you engage in those kinds of conversations so that they can steer you in lots of different directions, which is what learning is all about, particularly at the undergraduate level. And so as we think about education in the future, I think we have to think about it in a variety of ways. Obviously, nothing is the same today as it was 20 years ago. Students come to us having different expectations about how they will be taught, and so our faculty have to constantly refresh themselves, think differently about how they will deliver content, and most importantly, think differently about how they will encourage students to continue the thought process beyond what's happening in their classroom. So I don't think there's one answer, and I don't think that there's one way, and I think that in all of our institutions we will do it differently, and I think that we'll have to in order to meet the various needs of our students. You talked about the fact that the populations of students in the future will be primarily Hispanic and Black, and so we have to think about the context that we'll be operating in as we think about higher education, and there's not going to be one size that fits all.
Yeah. And Rich, to build off what Alicia said, a lot of the statistics also show that a lot of students won't be going to school full-time. A lot of students will be going part-time. We'll have an older population. That's actually going to be the new norm for higher education, not the 18, 19-year-old as we know it. So how do you see higher education, public and private, being able to compete in this landscape, particularly when you have, let's say, Starbucks entering the higher education field by offering college to their students through, you know, Pearson and ASU? So there's a huge privatization of the corporate sector coming in here. How will higher ed hold on within this sphere of competition and online learning and quality?
I think the first thing to say is that a student should be expected to learn how to learn in a variety of formats, a lecture, a seminar, a laboratory, and online. That is an important way of learning, but it shouldn't be the exclusive way of learning. Mm-hmm. I worry that the disaggregation of learning into one course at a time or one thing smaller than a course at a time for which you get a badge or certificate could, if carried too far, take away from what is the most important value of total immersion in higher education, which is the ability for you to discover things you never knew anything about, some of which may be the things that shape your future life. So it is true that it's expensive to go to school full-time, and something is better than nothing, clearly. And so the mechanisms that are growing up now to make college-level learning accessible in a variety of formats are clearly a good thing.
Great. Thank you very much. Mary, did you want to add in there?
I think that the conversation about, you know, the Starbucks and desegregation is particularly important right now in San Francisco. If we think about, I think we've gotten a little, those of us who have been in higher education have gotten a little bit skeptical about the next big thing or the end of college, or Alicia said she's still looking for something free. I think we're also still looking for the silver bullet. I don't think there is one. It's a particularly important conversation in San Francisco right now because not that long ago, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, we were all going to be put out of business by the for-profit colleges. And yes, was it Monday? Heald College, for-profit college here in San Francisco and in California, closed its doors. Mm-hmm. But that was what was going to be, you know, the next big thing. And the fact is the for-profit colleges have served some of the population that you identified. I also think the innovations push us in positive ways. But innovation is part of what we should do as institutions, and that's different than saying we're going to quit everything we've learned and everything we know how to do and start over. There was a period of time when every student had to learn spoken Latin as part of their, you know, part of their degree. And then there was a period of time where we all thought everyone needed to learn German. And then it was, what was after German? Russian. And then it was Japanese.
Yeah,
and
Chinese now.
Yeah. So I think that innovating, evolving the curriculum, adapting to the world and the environment, including using online technology, Rich's point about we should use all of these mediums, that's exactly right. But the kind of calamitous end of college seems a little bit extreme to those of us who've seen the end of college now several decades. Rich put me on a great national panel where we're talking about the future of private higher education. The first article we read was written in, I think it was 1928, and it said the liberal arts college is dead. So some of these conversations have been around for a while.
So much for the futurists.
Yes,
huh?
So much for the future of higher education.
You know, Monica, Kevin Carey has two young children, and among the people who know him in Washington, everyone's wondering where he's going to send his kids to school.
Yeah. Well, in his book, and you will disagree with it, but he projects that it's going to cost him $228,000 to send each of his kids to school in 15 years.
So he'll make all that money back.
That's
by a factor of five.
That's right. So we're gonna go back to the big picture as we end the program. I'm going to end with a question that, again, comes a little bit from the high cost of education as perceived by the public and the federal government. And basically, there's a movement right now for higher education to be accountable to parents, to communities, to government, to the actual students who go to school there and can finish in 4 years and not 6 years or 8 years. And so there's also been a movement to grade colleges. And this also came from the audience's question. And it's called a college scorecard. And higher education has pushed back on it, and then there's no consensus on whether that should occur or what the measure should be. So today I'm going to ask you, what do you think higher education should be graded on? And that will be our final question for the day.
I'll start. I think higher education should be accountable, but what those accountability measures would be, that I think that really is the bigger issue in terms of how we really add value to the society, how students would be much better off. I think one of the concerns that I have, if we just reduce everything to just a few numbers, it becomes analogous to that comment that for every complex questions there is a simple answer, and it's usually wrong. So what will it really this what would this give us is will be very much like what happened to our K-12. We'll be preparing everything on how we can really increase those scores rather than the deeper learning environment that all of our colleagues have talked about, and what should really be the role of higher education in that, instilling that learning to learn and really make the learning to be from a cradle to through our careers into the rest of our lives endeavor. I think that really is the most important element of higher education that we need to bring.
Alicia, what would you like your institution to be graded on?
Well, I do think that institutions of higher education should be held accountable. And I think that we should be held accountable for ensuring that students are leaving us with the ability to think critically, with the ability to communicate cogently or clearly, with the ability to reason, with the ability to solve problems, with the ability to solve the problems that we don't even know today exist, with the ability to really think through and to anticipate. Those are the kinds of things that I think we should be held accountable for, because that's the way in which we will engage our citizens going forward, because the issues that we're dealing with in today's citizenry, very different than the ones that we'll be dealing with 5-10 years from now. So we have to prepare students, and we should be held accountable for preparing students to be able to address whatever issues come to them in the years ahead.
Rich and Mary, and then we'll end with UC Berkeley.
I agree with Alicia. And in fact, colleges and universities are held accountable now through a system of accrediting organizations that serve particular fields as well as institutions as a whole. The important thing about these accrediting organizations is that they're non-governmental, and they're able to respond to the great variety of differences in this wide diversity of kinds of colleges and universities we have. I worry about putting direct government regulation in place instead of these voluntary bodies that serve as intermediaries and do a pretty good job on the whole in recognizing the sensitivities and the differences.
And I would add only that I think we should be held accountable to some degree simply truth in advertising. When we started this conversation, I said that one of the great strengths of American higher education is its diversity. And I believe that continues to be true. But that suggests that we should have different measures for different types of institutions. But we should be held accountable for what it is we say we're going to accomplish. You know, if we say, you know, as Alicia and I have said today, that we have a commitment to serving students of color, underrepresented students, first-generation students, then we need to be held accountable in the outcomes for those students. Do they graduate at the same rate? Do they have success afterwards in similar ways? And I know it's safe for me to say that because I know we look at that data all the time. But it seems to me that that's a different, it's not a one-size-fits-all answer, but it is owning what it is that we say we're going to do and making sure that we're actually doing that.
Great. Appreciate that. And last but not least, Claude from the University of California.
Well, I feel accountable, and I think I speak for a lot of colleagues. I'm sure I speak for everybody on this panel. I think we really do feel accountable to fulfill the mission of our institutions. And, you know, one concrete way of putting it is I would like students to come to Berkeley and to realize all of the advantage, to get the maximum out of it. Where I would feel disappointed is if I felt students came and somehow didn't adequately engage, or they didn't have the... We didn't give them the wherewithal to broaden their experience, to find out what it is that they don't know. You know, a lot, we don't know what we don't know. You want students to have some to have the kind of experience where they see new things and imagine themselves in new ways. And if that wasn't happening, if our classes were too big or there was too much pressure or whatever the circumstances are, I would feel, and I think my colleagues would feel accountable to that. We would want to design the university, to design that experience in ways that enable students to have that kind of life-shaping experience there. That's just to give you the kind of personal sense that I think a lot of educators have. It's why we got into education as part of the personal mission of most of the colleagues that I think, and that generalizes to the institutions as well. The official ways of accountability, I think I share the perspectives expressed here. Be careful what you measure. You could reduce a great institution down to a silly set of outcome measures that, I won't go on in that vein, but I think it's really hard to measure some of the biggest, if the audience just thinks about their own experience in college, I think it's really hard to reduce that to a set of simple measures that you can put on a dashboard and say this college is better than this college. That would be a very dangerous direction. I don't think it served K through 12 well, which is probably the point of your book. And I don't think it would serve higher education that well either.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We've just really touched on these very big questions, and there's so much more complexity and so much more we can talk about with the alignment of higher education and K-12 as well that we didn't get to. But I really appreciate the inroads we made in talking about access, affordability, and success in higher education. I want to thank our sponsor, Charles Schwab Foundation, for supporting this program, and to Helen Lowe for her introduction. I most especially want to thank our guests, starting from Alicia Decadrew, from the president for Mills College, Richard Eckham, president of the Council of Independent Colleges, Mary Marcy, president of Dominican University of California, Claude Still, executive vice chancellor and provost of the University of California, and Mohammed Kiyome, the president from California State University, San Jose. We also want to thank our audience here in person. We want to thank our audience on the radio, television, and the internet. I am Monica Martinez, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.